all you fish enthusiasts out there, whether you're an avid angler or just curious about fish, we'd like to welcome you to Fish of the Week, your audio almanac of all the fish. It's Monday, June 10th, 2024, and we're on a week-by-week tour of fish across the country with guests from all walks of life. I'm Katrina Liebig with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska.
I'm Guy Hero, and today we're going to be talking about the Pacific sleeper shark.
We have two guests, both joining us from NOAA Fisheries. Beth Matta is a research fisheries biologist in the Age and Growth Program at the Alaska Fisheries Science Center. Cindy Tribuzio, who joined us for Salmon Sharks in Season 1. She's a research biologist with the Alaska Fisheries Science Center's Auk Bay Laboratory. So welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so this is a super cool, mysterious shark. We're hoping you can both help us visualize what the Pacific sleeper shark looks like, and if it's got any like physical superlatives it can claim, so we can have a good image as we move forward into the episode.
Well, they look like a log floating in the water. They are slow swimmers. They don't have that sharky speed that you see on TV. They're very bendy. They're very maneuverable. They get very large. They start at about half a meter, or, you know, 2 to 3 feet, and they can grow up to supposedly about 7 meters, which is about 20 feet in length. We don't have a verified record of that. That's based on some submarine images that were taken next to a known size item and then estimated the size. The largest that we have a verified length for is 4.6 meters. And as they get longer, they get a lot more round. So they gain a lot of girth. And so even though it says, it seems, oh, they're long. They're long and big.
Okay.
And they're mostly a dark gray to black coloring, universally top and bottom. A lot of sharks you see is like gray on top and whitish on the bottom. These are the same color all around. And they just kind of cruise in the water and don't really expend a lot of energy on swimming. That's why I call them kind of a log.
That size has got to be kind of one of the larger sharks, correct? In the ocean, one of the larger predatory ones?
Yes, we think it's one of the longest non-plankton feeding sharks in the ocean.
And the other thing I was going to say about them was their teeth. They do not have the real sharp, bitey teeth that you think of with sharks, the typical rip and shred type of teeth that you see with great whites. Sleeper sharks have more of a slanted saw blade style tooth, so they tend to take cleaner circular bites.
Yeah, that's the bottom teeth too. They're a little bit different from the top teeth. The top teeth are intended a little bit more for grabbing, and then the bottom teeth can kind of cut out chunks of food. A lot of what they feed on is scavenge materials, so they can tear big chunks of whale or dead seal or whatever off pretty easily.
Okay.
They do have really nice big eyes. Biggest ones are about the size of cantaloupes.
That is crazy. Very cool. I'm looking at the picture I have, and their eye looks very small to be cantaloupe size potentially. That just kind of blows my mind.
Yeah. When you look behind what you actually see, there's a big globe of tissue.
Yeah.
You would think that they would be a very visually based predator, but they're not, because they get the parasites that grow on their eyes. They essentially all have them, and they're essentially all damaged on their corneas from this.
They probably rely on their sense of smell far more than their eyes anyway.
Yes.
Their olfactory region of their brain is really large, even for their large size body. And if you think about the depths that they occupy, some of these depths are pretty deep and there's no light that can really be seen. They're using their sniffer to find.
So they're sniffing out like a whale fall or
whale
something
fall.
Like that. Or a whale.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And there's been some cool documentation of them feeding on whale falls up in Alaska.
I don't even know if people know that term really well.
Oh,
whale fall.
Yeah. A whale fall is basically, you know, whales live their life and then they die and they sink to the bottom of the ocean. And it's a bonanza for all sorts of scavengers. This can provide a really important food source. Sleeper sharks have been documented feeding on these whale falls up in the Gulf of Alaska in particular.
Are they actually pursuing any prey, or are they totally a scavenger, do we know?
Oh, that's a good question too. We talked a bit about their teeth, and they have these grabby teeth on the top and more sawing teeth on the bottom. And they also have the capability of suction feeding. We know they also swim very slowly, but there's evidence that they may actually sneak up on, say, sleeping seals and other marine life and actually ambush them. They've documented in sleeper shark stomachs pretty intact tissues of some of these pelagic prey. They found salmon. They found seals that don't look like they were scavenged off the bottom. They seem to really eat a wide variety of food and appear to be pretty opportunistic.
Yeah. They eat fast food too. Like you said, salmon.
Like McDonald's?
Squid. Yeah, I was going to say.
Wahoo?
Like yeah. McDonald's? No.
Yeah.
I'd say there's compelling evidence that they can and possibly do predate on even fast swimming food. The one that I read recently that I was truly fascinated. So orcas, especially out in the Aleutian Islands, will kill gray whales or whatever and stash it. They'll cache their food source and that will attract sleeper sharks. They'll come and feed on the whales' caches. But killer whales, especially offshores, do also specialize feeding on elasmobranchs, including Pacific sleeper sharks. So killer whales will come and eat the Pacific sleeper sharks at the same time. So there's some circular predatory behavior. Huh.
I wonder if they're intentionally baiting them in. Like I've seen videos of like a bird will take a piece of bread and instead of eating the bread, they'll put it on the waterline and then eat the fish that try to eat the bread. So I wonder if that's intentional or if it's just a byproduct that was stashed and then we got this other thing.
I don't know if anybody's speculated on that.
Orcas are smart.
I haven't seen any research suggesting that behavior, but they do go to specific areas where sleeper sharks are known to be to specifically hunt them. One example is there's a sill, which is a shallow spot between two deep areas in between Southeast Alaska and British Columbia. And everything has to swim up and over that to get from one side to the next.
You call it a sill?
A sill. S-I-L-L? It's like a shallow spot. Okay. Just a small, shallow in between two islands. And the orcas will hang out there because when the sharks come up and over it, they can go down and reach them and predate on them there.
That's cool. Yeah. The orcas, man. Gosh.
They feed on sharks. So this particular population that Cindy is talking about, they feed on sharks so vigorously that they'll actually wear their teeth down to nubs. Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah. Huh. They specialize in elasmobranchs.
Yeah.
And could be skates, could be sharks.
Yeah. And it's the rough skin at the shark is wearing the teeth.
Yep. Like sandpaper.
That is cool. Huh.
Yep.
I want to talk a little bit about the lenses and as this relates to your work, Beth, because your age and growth. And if I remember back to what the Greenland shark expert that we had on was talking about, you're actually using the lenses to try to age the fish in the absence of things like otoliths. So I would like for you to tell me a little bit more about that. If you could describe what the lenses actually feel and look like too, I'd really appreciate it.
Okay. So they're composed mostly of crystalline proteins. The outer layers, initially they are fiber cells and then they lose their nuclei as they become hardened over time. So more the interior part of the core. And so the outer layer is kind of like jelly almost.
You had me at cantaloupe.
Well, by the time you get to the lens, even that big eye, the lens is actually pretty small. And it doesn't seem like there's a relationship so far in our early data between the size of the animal and the size of the core of the lens. And to me, it reminds me of like a glass marble that's kind of bumpy, not real smooth, kind of a messy glass marble.
Eye lenses are really cool, and sleeper sharks, like all vertebrates, your eye lenses form in concentric layers as you age. The interior of the eye lens is not reworked, so it basically represents all the conditions that you're exposed to early in life. So your eye lenses actually start developing in utero. We're comparing book signatures in the eye lens with bomb radiocarbon, which is heavy carbon-14, and that we can use to date the eye lenses and also figure out how old the fish is.
So how does that dating work? So I get the layering that you can count layers and figure that out, but how do you place this bomb carbon?
Bomb radiocarbon. We peel off all the outer layers of the lens, and then we have that interior core. And so we can use a machine called an accelerator mass spectrometer, and that can measure the amount of carbon-14 in the eye lens. And we have reference data from corals and fish of known age all throughout the world. When bomb testing was happening during the Cold War, it increased the amount of carbon-14 in the atmosphere, and that worked its way into the oceans. And so we can compare the measured amount of carbon-14 in the core of the islands to these reference chronologies and basically date the islands. Like, we can say, oh, okay, there's this rapid rise in carbon-14 because of the bomb testing. That is just a really accurate way to date materials that were in existence at that time.
Yeah. I know that Greenland sharks are like one of the oldest vertebrates on Earth. How do these guys compare? What's the oldest eye that you've aged so far?
Well, so far, the largest shark that we have aged using this method, it was a 3.1 meter shark. So I think that's what, about 10, 11 feet in length. That shark, it fell right on that really rapid rise of bomb carbon. And so that tells us that that shark was born around that time. So around the 1960s, and this particular shark was collected, I think, what was it, about 2010? Yeah. So we think that shark was about 50 years old at the time, which is, compared to Greenland sharks of similar size, from that study, they found that size shark was about 105. So we're looking at like half as old. But this particular shark was also immature, because we think the size at maturity is much bigger.
Immature at 50 years old.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
They'll probably live quite a long time, but so far it's not looking like it's nearing the Greenland shark longevity.
Do you have any hypotheses about why these ones, they seem to grow faster and maybe live less long than the Greenland sharks?
We don't have enough information yet, simply because we really are in the pilot stages of this study. So other than saying we've done a few samples that suggest that at a younger age they grow faster, we can't really speculate beyond that yet.
Cindy, so we don't actually know a lot about it, right? There's still a lot to know. And I'm kind of curious what we know about its basic biology and what we still don't know.
Ooh, what we know is very little. We know they get big. They get caught in some fisheries. Somewhere there have to be adults. We do not see adults, but they have to exist because there's babies. We know that they grow and they die. The most important information for stock assessment is what we're missing. Like the age of maturity, the longevity, the things we're working towards. These are the gaps that we're missing. So this is why we consider this a severely data-limited species. We really only have catch data to inform our stock assessment. We don't even catch them regularly in surveys. So we don't have even a standardized way of tracking their population. A lot of the basic biology is not understood. There have been diet studies, because you can use stable isotopes in muscle tissue to look at what they've eaten through time. We've done some genetic studies, which has actually been very fascinating, and some people are more interested in expanding on the genetics work. The first genetic study that we published, this is Laura Tim's paper, came out in 2023, found that all of the sleeper sharks that she had samples of, which ranged from the Bering Sea to British Columbia to the Southern Oceans and to Taiwan, were essentially one mixed population. And that sounds like, woo, they're huge, they're everywhere. But it actually had a very small effect of sample size. And what that translates to is that there's not a lot of genetic diversity in the population. The other amazing thing that came out of that study is that there was a sibling pair found in the Bering Sea.
Oh, cool.
Most of what we catch from fisheries are small sleeper sharks. So we are kind of developing a hypothesis that the Bering Sea is a critical nursery habitat. This is just in the early stages of theory. This is not something that we've actually put research effort into yet. But the genetics also support that, because they found two animals that were essentially caught, I think it was 30 kilometers apart, and they were about the same size and within a month of each other. And so they're found to be a sibling pair. That is an extremely rare situation.
That's lucky. Wow.
It's very lucky. We have a lot of samples from the Bering Sea because the fisheries that catch that species are 100% observed. And so we've been able to get a lot of samples from that area. So we have a fairly broad scope of sampling in that area. We will be expanding the genetics work in the future. So all that biology I just told you aside isn't actually immediately integratable into the stock assessment. It's kind of accessory information that we're feeding into the assessment, and it helps us to consider things like how vulnerable the population could be to fishing, but we don't have enough data to actually develop the metrics we normally use in stock assessment.
Yeah. And when you say stock assessment, just in layman's terms, that's just kind of like understanding how they're doing.
Yes.
Essentially.
Yeah. Stock assessment is, you know, the mathematical processes that we use to estimate the status of the population, if possible, and how many fish can sustainably be harvested as best as we can based on the data. And at NOAA, we're mandated by law to do this. So we're doing this for all the stocks that we manage.
When you've got a data deficient species like this, how does the precautionary principle factor into management decisions?
So there's fishery management councils all around the country. And at the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, we have 6 levels of assessments based on how much information you have going into it. Tier 6 is our lowest data level tier, and it's based on catch history or whatever metrics you can develop that are informed by data. Currently, it's an area of expanded research, and that's something that we're working on with this stock, is developing an updated method, we'll say, for estimating harvest rates for the species based on adding in this accessory data that we haven't been able to integrate in the past. And this law that I mentioned, the Magnuson-Stevens Act, we use catch history, which assumes that what we had caught in the past is okay to catch in the future. This is a species that's not targeted. People don't want to catch it. They're avoiding it. Vessels do not want to deal with large sharks on their deck. It's a safety issue. They damage gear. So saying that they're not targeted and probably what we were catching in the past is okay for the future is not a bad assumption to make. And then we take that one step further in our management principles and we say, but we're going to buffer that by another 25%. We're not going to let you catch a certain number even below what we think is sustainable. So we've got this uncertainty buffer in our system. And that's present at all levels. That buffer is different at each level. For the tier 6 level, it's 25% or some other value that we set. It's a little different at each level and each stock. Every stock has its own separate assessment. So for our sharks, we have right now set at 25% below what we think is a sustainable catch rate. We've bumped it down and said, okay, here's what we think is okay, but we're going to tell you to use these numbers just to be safe.
Where are they being caught? What depths? What are people fishing for when they're coming across these sharks?
That really depends on where you are and what the target fisheries are in a given area. In Southeast Alaska or other near shore waters, they tend to catch sleeper sharks and halibut fisheries. There's something about the gear. They are more susceptible to that gear as opposed to like sablefish gear. That's a great question. Other areas, they're caught in flatfish fisheries near Shelikof or in the pollock fisheries in the Bering Sea. Those are the areas where they tend to run in them more than other areas.
What's the deepest they've been caught or seen?
They've been viewed very deep. They've been viewed using drop cameras and submersible cameras, 2,000 meters, which is really, really deep. That's over a mile, I think, right? Most of our fisheries are not going anywhere near that deep. Surveys don't tend to go that deep. We used to have a survey in the Bering Sea called the Continental Slope Survey, where we were getting them, I think, up to 1,200 meters is the deepest we'd go.
Okay. So big range, variety of depths.
Strangely enough, with this species, they tend to come more shallower at the higher latitudes. And so we're really not seeing them at those extreme survey depths even. The slope survey that Beth mentioned, I think the catches of them were between 300 and 500 meters.
Yeah.
They weren't even getting that deep. So they do come shallower at higher latitudes, possibly because the daylight's not so intense, the water's cooler, the food.
So we've talked that they have a large range. What specifically is their range? Is it just the northern hemisphere within the Pacific Basin?
recently found out, thanks to Laura's paper that Cindy mentioned earlier, that what we thought were two different species, one, the Somnosis pacificus, Pacific sleeper shark, in the northern hemisphere of the Pacific Ocean, and Somnosis antarcticus, which was called the southern sleeper shark in the southern hemisphere of the Pacific Ocean, are not genetically distinct. So it looks to be one big population. There's really no population substructure that we can tell from the genetics testing that we've done. That said, the tagging work that we've done hasn't shown that they have moved super far, but they might be capable of moving far distances. We just really don't know.
Yeah. I mean, there are some currents that distinguish the northern and the southern basins, but it's not like they're up on the surface where it's like going to be a heat issue that keeps them from going. So
They even in tropical latitudes, they've seen them like off of around Hawaii and some other areas in the South Pacific that are off pretty warm, but they're deep.
Yeah. So deep vents.
The taxonomist may has got a question. If those two get subsumed into a single species, I don't know if I'm using subsumed correctly, but if they become the same species, which one has priority? Will the Pacific become Antarcticus, or will the Antarctic become the Pacificus? Oh, which one came first?
That's a good question. I'm not a taxonomist. I don't really know.
Yeah. It's like, I'm not going to be determined out on that one.
Hang on. This one is a Google search. And I know this wasn't on your list of things that you're probably going to be asked.
So when fishermen encounter the shark on their lines, are they getting any data when they collect the shark? How are they dealing with it on their deck? Do they get released alive? Do you know? I assume there's some kind of maybe call to action there. You guys are working with fishermen to some degree.
We have a number of initiatives going on to improve data quality for the species. The first one is that we have a project dealing with electronic monitoring technologies. So some fisheries are starting to use cameras on board instead of humans as observers. And so developing machine learning tools to review the video, identify when a shark is caught. That part's done. And we're using that to gauge how big they are. And that is a whole new data stream. We didn't have size data before. So we're working directly with industry, and we have a few vessels specifically that we're working with, but also directly with all the industry on this, where we're getting data directly on size that we were not getting before. And then there's another electronic monitoring program on trawl vessels. It's a totally different program. Same idea, they're using cameras instead of people, but it's for different purposes. And in that case, the on-deck crew are measuring the sharks in this case. So I'm getting an actual measured, confirmed length to go with the sharks. And the first program I spoke of is just on longline gears. And those sharks are never brought on board. From that video, though, we've been able to categorize the release of the sharks. Most of them are simply the shark head breaking the surface of the water and falling off the hook, swimming away. Occasionally, they do get wrapped up in the gear, and I'd say at least half the time, the vessel crew does their best to get them untangled so they can swim away. But again, they're starting to consider safety issues at this point. These are not big vessels. These are small vessels. That's why they're trying to use cameras instead of adding at-sea observers. So they do their best to disentangle and let the sharks swim away as much as possible. On trawl vessels, it's a little more difficult because the sharks are soft. They're softer bodied. They don't have a lot of calcium in their cartilage. They're not real rigid muscular structure, so they get squished. And so based on some tagging data that we've done, it suggests that the way they're currently being handled, they're probably more deceased when they're released. There's a vessel group that is looking at doing some research on that, and they're trying to find funding to do research on that. So it's an actively engaged industry. We have a lot of participation from at-sea observers who are voluntarily collecting data for us on top of all their other duties. They've taken length measurements. They've taken eye collections. They deal with sending us frozen eyes. So we've had a huge network of participants helping us expand how we're getting data on this species and are leveraging all these different platforms that we weren't using before.
Yeah, it seems like you have to kind of go that collaborative route to get information on a species like this. That's really neat.
It takes a village.
It takes a village. And to be honest, it's a lot more fun to work with a village. It just really is. The local knowledge and the institutional knowledge that vessel operators, crew, and observers have is so different from what we get in our data streams.
We could do this project without them.
Guy, did you find your taxonomy answer?
I did. So, drum roll, please. Here's the answer. Pacific sleeper shark was described in 1944 and Southern in 1939. So the Pacific sleeper shark would cease to be. I mean, obviously, it would still exist. It would be the Southern.
We'll have to rename. We'll have to rename the episode maybe in the future.
Yeah.
We don't talk about commercial fisheries and let alone monitoring on too many episodes. And I think automated fisheries monitoring is one of the coolest uses of AI that I've heard so far. I mean, who cares about ChatGPT or Sora video creation? I like it being able to measure and identify fish.
I'm curious if either of you remember the first time you got interested in the shark or the first time you came across one of them. Beth, I think I saw one of your photos from when you held your first baby sleeper.
I was pretty much fresh out of college. I was working my first job and I was on my first survey, which was that Bering Sea Continental Slope Survey. We just so happened to come across the largest documented aggregation of Pacific sleeper sharks.
Wow. How big is the largest documented aggregation? That sounds like they're pretty rare.
We caught over 100. It's a trawl vessel that we're on, and we caught over 100 in one trawl in Zemchug Canyon, so a deep water canyon in the Bering Sea. And they were all immature individuals, some of them quite small. And that photo that is in the web story is of a juvenile, probably pretty young sleeper shark. Mm-hmm. And I was hooked. I wanted to know more about them. And unfortunately, we don't know a ton more since that time, which was quite a long time ago. I'm not going to date myself, but Cindy's work has really, really propelled our knowledge.
I came into sharks a little strange. I was always trying to study whales and got hooked up with spiny dogfish research in my master's. And then I came up to Alaska to do spiny dogfish research for my PhD. And that's what got me my job. And so through my job doing the shark assessment, how the transition from one species to the other kind of occurred is that I got dogfish into a stable place on the stock assessment so I could start focusing on the other species. Spiny dogfish are also considered data limited, but we have a lot more information. And based on what we have in their stock assessment, they're okay. Like, there are no flags. It's trucking along, behaving itself. You know, everything's fine. There's no market for them. Nobody wants to catch them. They're very annoying. People are trying to avoid them. So we really don't have any concerns right now for that species, which has allowed me to shift resources to these other species where we need to actively start filling in more of the gaps to ensure that we don't develop concerns.
Yeah, that's exciting. Exciting place to be.
Yeah. I'm not a certified dyslexic or anything, but every time I see your last name, I think, very appropriate that she's studying sharks.
You like to elaborate, Guy?
Shark is Trabuzio and Tiburone. There's some extra letters in there. It's missing an N, but I think it's close enough.
I see that.
Getting back to that 100 shark aggregation, that seems to imply at least one of two things. If you're getting all those in one trawl set, either one pupping event can produce 100 sharks, or you have multiple sharks pupping in a very close proximity to each other. Is one of those been shown to be true, or what do you think about that?
That's a really good question. They have gone back and resampled in that area since and never caught anywhere near that number of sharks again. What we think of as nursery areas for sharks are persistent over time. But on the other hand, yes, they were all young, or not young, I shouldn't say young. They were all small. And I think the biggest one might have been 2 meters, but most of them were much smaller. Our best evidence for litter size comes from Greenland sharks. And there's a ton of debate about how many babies they can have at one time. So the females, it's really interesting. They have these ovaries with huge yellow eggs in them, full of yellow eggs, like over 300 in one female. And these eggs are all, you know, 5 centimeters, so a couple inches in diameter, so pretty big. Some people have speculated that they give live birth, so that they have births of 300 at a time. I see that as being really space limiting, because what we know is that they're about 40 centimeters when they're born. So
wow. That's a lot of
about shark. That's a lot of shark.
That's yeah. A lot of mass.
Yeah, I just don't see that being physically possible.
I know you guys are marine and shark field. Have you ever seen fathead minnows?
No.
Yes. I'm just imagining a Greenland shark like a fathead minnow.
I'll have to look that up.
They get swollen.
To date, we've never actually caught a pregnant female Pacific flipper shark. There is one anecdotal account that we documented in a paper that we did recently where a fisheries observer saw a pregnant female come up on board, and she actually gave birth to about 10-ish pups, he thought. But, you know, they got her back into the water right away. And so whether she continued to have more or she had some on the way up onto the deck, we don't really know. This was about 30 years ago, too.
Oh, wow.
But that's kind of the best account that we have for this particular species. And then everything else we know is from the Greenland shark. And they don't really have a whole lot of data on their reproductive biology either, unfortunately.
I do remember the Greenland sharks, the gestation period was something ridiculous.
And to put it back in context, though, there's only one documented pregnant Greenland shark that's ever been observed. And I think it was 1957. And she had 10 pups. So there's just not a lot of information.
Gosh.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So what can we take from what we know of the age of maturation, maybe the longevity and just some of the other biological features? And how does that inform how we would think about conservation of this species and just what we need to think about?
Well, what we can fairly safely infer is that this is a slow-growing species with a likely slow population growth rate, meaning that even if they do have hundreds of pups, they're not doing it very often. The population growth rate is probably very slow. The individual animal's growth rate is very slow. Everything about it is just stretched out. You know, we talked about that Zemchug Canyon aggregation and how it hasn't been repeated since. We tend to think of things annually. So we think of animals as having an annual reproductive cycle. And so you'll see what we call cohorts, which are groups of similar aged animals. But for species like this, that cohort that we think of annually could be stretched over a decade. So you could have a decade-long cohort instead of a year-long cohort. And so everything about this is stretched out beyond human frame of reference, even. We mature in our early teens, and we have a lifespan in the 70s, 80s. Like, take that and just double, triple everything. And what that likely means is that the species by itself is probably more susceptible to being over-harvested. But that doesn't mean that's what's occurring if most of the population is not susceptible to being harvested. We have vulnerability, and then we have susceptibility. Vulnerability is, yes, the population could be highly vulnerable given its biological characteristics. Susceptibility is how much are we actually catching? Like, how likely is it to be caught? And so taking those two things separately, being highly vulnerable does not always mean you're being over-harvested. It just means got to keep an eye on things.
Yep.
And what we can infer about this species is that there's probably a lot of the adult population we don't see. We don't see it. We don't sample it. We don't have access to learn about it. And what we probably are seeing up here in Alaska is the younger population, the newborns up through early subadults, maybe some adults, but by and large, we're looking at the young population that's up here. What does that mean for the population as a whole? There's a lot of really great anecdotal information. I've had local fishermen here in Southeast Alaska tell me that they've had long line sets where they caught also 100 of the exact same size shark. So there could be reproductive events occurring where multiple sharks show up in the same area. A single shark has a giant litter. Either way, it's a slow process.
So Beth, in the article, it said that when you were kind of digging into the literature, you utilized many obscure resources in your research. I'm curious if you could enlighten us on to what some of these obscure resources
were. Sure. That was a trip, and it is really fun actually to dig back into scientific literature from 100 years ago because they just had a very different way of describing things. It's a lot of naturalists actually just making observations. Some of these were really valuable, like the documentation of the Greenland shark that was pregnant. That was from the 1950s, and that is the best information we have. So. Right. Some of these, it's the best we have to go on just because they're so hard to observe otherwise. I did look at newspapers as well, magazines. National Geographic actually had a really cool article with photos from 1990, I think, with Eugenie Clark, who I don't know if
you
know her. She's known as the Shark Lady. She kind of pioneered shark science. She was definitely a personal pioneer for me as a woman in shark science. And she went on a submersible tour of Suruga Bay in Japan, and she saw one of the largest sleeper sharks on record.
Cool. Lucky her.
Yeah.
That's neat. Any final calls to action or reasons that really people should think about, you know, caring about this shark?
Their biology is so mysterious, and the fact that they exist is just amazing. It's so different from what we think about as far as a lifestyle. It's so long and stretched out. It's just amazing that it just exists this way. And it has for probably a long time. And there's so much we can't understand because we don't even see the animals. And, you know, as humans, we're so used to saying we have data on things. We know we can learn this by just collecting data. We can't even collect data on a huge portion of the population. And that's really cool. It's a challenge, but it's so interesting because, as you noted, there's like a paper in a naturalist journal from 100 years ago, and that's valuable. That's a really valuable observation. Every once in a while, you just get this little nubbin of information that you find, and it's just like finding gold. It's very exciting. Mm-hmm.
I think sharks are so cool, and I'm excited that people seem to care more about them now than when I was growing up. I hope that we can continue our research and learn more about the species and getting people to think outside the box and come up with creative ways to study them. I think there's just tons of opportunities for more work to be done.
So when should we have you two back on? In like 10 years to get updates or what? Yeah. Like if the podcast is still going, when are you going to have some of these questions maybe answered, you think?
We're kind of at peak right now with what we're trying to do and like launching a lot of initiatives on getting work done. And so I think our next assessment is scheduled for 2026. Hopefully by the time we roll through that, we'll have finished the eye aging project. Our machine learning stuff will be catching up and our assessment method efforts will be hopefully rolling into management uses. So you know, I think within a couple, 2 years from now, I think we'll have a lot more information to say.
Okay. Perfect. We definitely have that many fish to cover. 2 more years of fish at least. So yeah, awesome. Thank you both so much. This was fascinating.
Thank you so much. You guys asked great questions. Some stumpers.
Yeah. Usually Guy.
Thanks. Enjoyed it.
I'll get out there and live from, discover and enjoy all the fish, especially some of these mysterious species like the Pacific sleeper shark. Thanks for listening to Fish of the Week. My name is Katrina Liebeck, and my co-host is Guy Iro. Fish of the Week is a production of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Region Office of Communications. Our production partner for the series is Citizen Race Car. We honor, thank, and celebrate the whole community, individual tribes, states, our sister agencies, fish enthusiasts, scientists, and others who have elevated our understanding and love as people and professionals of all the fish.